From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, the writer Ellen Molloy. You might remember Ellen from her books or maybe from the beautiful and funny essay she did for KUER from her home in Bluff. Ellen died in 2004, but recently we rediscovered her radio essays and collected them, published them in a book called Seasons. We're talking about Ellen, playing some of her stories, and we hope you'll join us after this.
This has been a busy year in the KUER newsroom. From religion...
How is this a moral issue, and do you see it that way?
To politics...
Democrat Ben McAdams has an edge over incumbent Mia Love.
To our region...
For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie.
KUER has spent 2018 reporting the stories that matter to you. In the new year, we plan to cover even more. You can support the growth of trustworthy journalism here in Utah. Go to KUER.org and click donate. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It seemed as though Ellen Molloy was on her way as a writer back in 2004. Her book, The Anthropology of Turquoise, had been nominated for a Pulitzer not long before. She had just finished another book called Eating Stone. And she had only been writing for about 10 years, really. She was 58, and maybe she had started late, but people were noticing. But in November of that year, Ellen died suddenly. Those of us who knew her were completely taken by surprise. Ellen used to write essays for KUER, and in one of them, she gives her precise location and concentric geography. She mentions her house on 8 acres in Bluff, Utah, affixed to the south flank of the San Juan River. The house faces a cliff, and she says it's not that far from Monument Valley on the Navajo Reservation. And there it is, as she puts it, house, river, the res, the Colorado Plateau, Utah, America, the world, the universe. The essay is called I Stapled My Hair to the Roof.
I have just stapled my hair to the roof. I was unfurling heavy rolls of black felt over the pitched roof. Then I would lean in and staple the felt in place with tin caps. This requires grunt labor more than skill, but I was daydreaming about snowy egrets and leaned too far. I'm my own boss. I'm in no particular rush. The day is so clear you could bite it. It seems a good time to enjoy the view and contemplate the dazzling spectacle of women awakening to their own full powers. With a slight twist, I lie on my back. Stapled to the roof, I have serious thoughts about human potential. My Navajo neighbors have lived for centuries in a matrilineal society. In pioneer times, while the men mumbled about posses and punched each other's lights out, the grandmothers of my Anglo neighbors simply got off their horses and took care of business. Rural women could always raise roofs and corn, kids and hell. Yet today one speaks of women marching into equality as if that were a different country. No, I think, as two turkey vultures circle above me, we're simply occupying the rest of what has always been home. House, town, country, the world, the universe. The turkey vultures don't see this geography of possibility. They see me, an edible, two-legged smudge on a plywood platter. I extricate my hair and return to felt and staple gun. Before I finish, two parties pass by on the highway. They pull over and watch, then offer me jobs. But I only have one roof in me, my own, and what I'd really like to do next is to run a tractor or a government, perhaps a particle accelerator.
Ellen Molloy, who died in November of 2004. Today in the program, we are talking about Ellen, about her life and her work. Joining us is Donald Snow. He's the chair and senior lecturer of environmental humanities at Whitman College in Walla Walla, Washington. He's on the board of the Ellen Molloy Fund, which makes annual grants to desert writers, and Donald is joining us from a studio in Walla Walla. And Donald Snow, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Ann Weiler Walka is joining us also. She's a poet, a naturalist based in Bluff, Utah, and also in Flagstaff, Arizona. She's on the Ellen Molloy Fund board as well and is joining us from KNAU. It's a public radio station in Flagstaff. And Ann Weiler-Walker, welcome to you.
Thank you.
I'll mention KUAR is partnering with Torrey House Press to release a collection of radio essays that Ellen wrote for us in the 90s. You'll be hearing some of those throughout the program today. We'll give you a little bit more information about that as we go along. Donald Snow, listening to that essay, Stapled My Hair to the Roof, what does that make you think of in terms of the way Ellen wrote and her, just her perspective and her sense of humor?
Well, that's the thing, the perspective and the sense of humor. It's vintage Ellen. I mean, the piece is just hilarious. And, you know, she finds herself in a kind of Perils of Pauline dilemma down there on the roof of a desert house, made all the funnier by the fact that vultures are circling overhead, looking at her as she says she's a smudge on the roof below them. That's how she wrote. That's how she thought. She was like that on the page, and she was like that in real life. So that's the full Ellen.
Yeah. She wasn't just funny when she wrote. She was funny? Like when you met her, when you interacted with her, she was funny?
Yeah, she was hilarious. Real dry, kind of droll sense of humor. Loved to costume herself, loved to crack jokes. She liked funny people as well. You know, you never, whenever you went over to Ellen's place, you didn't expect to be bored. You know, whoever was there, you know, would be part of the humor. And part of the problem was just keeping up with Ellen's wit. It was just unquenchable.
And I guess you tried to keep up with her wit from time to time?
Oh, I tried, but really, I was a little daunted by it sometimes, too, because I'm not a funny person, but I loved her wit, and I loved her being funny, and I really enjoyed so many seeming contradictions in Ellen's personality.
Yeah.
And one was that she was very funny, and the other was that she was very serious, and her writing shows both of those things, I think.
It's true. Don, you met Ellen before she discovered the desert, I think, when she lived in Montana. It's hard for me to imagine her having a full sense of nature writing or writing about the environment before she did discover the American Southwest. But when she was there in Montana, when you knew her, what was her sense of place, of the environment?
Well, she was a little bit of a fish out of water in Montana, and she wrote about it in one of the essays that you've brought to light here in the collection. Just the sheer coldness of Montana, how far north it is. And remember that we're talking about the late 1970s, so Montana was colder than it is now. It's definitely warmed up for some obvious reasons. But her sense of the outdoors was just palpable. She loved rivers. In fact, that's some of my first adventures with Ellen were on the local rivers, the rivers local to Missoula, primarily the Bitterroot. I remember once floating the Yellowstone with her on the other end of the state. So she, you know, she made the best of that place. That was not really kind of a natural home for her. She loved the sun and she loved heat. You know, she came from California originally. So her adventure from Montana down to the desert was, in a certain sense, a kind of homecoming for her.
Here's a section from an essay that Donald Snow was mentioning before. This was recorded in 1996, and it's called Simply Montana.
Under the western sky, comfort is found in your own insignificance. As a young, insignificant woman, I believe that Montana was big enough to hold my restlessness. I thought I might find root in a place of this size. I went to Montana as a native Westerner, exchanging one outback home for another. The growing season was so brief I had to jump-start my garden inside a junked farm truck that sat on its axle in my backyard. The truck made a perfect greenhouse. Its cab and windshield faced south for solar gain. Its windows adjusted for ventilation. In Montana, I survived winters of brittle, frigid air that burned the skin like poison needles. I boldly crawled under the house to thaw my pipes with a blow dryer. When a severe cold snap froze every molecule of liquid in my house except a tumbler of whiskey, I drank the whiskey. In Montana, I learned to row a river, belly dance, and herd sheep. I frost-nipped my feet on ski trips in moonlight. I rearranged my knees on treks with a heavy pack. The land seemed so vast, each season so deep, adventure was irresistible. Those years matched youth to place, reckless energy to a land that does not yield easy living to anyone. I lived in a town with a past as Western as bullet holes in a stop sign. As it outgrew its frontier motliness, the locals wanted churches and schools. Visitors from the East wanted bugling elk and virile men who punched each other's lights out. These days, los hombres de global economy dress like Garth Brooks on weekends, but demand a four-lane to the ski lift. They want cow poop on their boots and Ralph Lauren in their living rooms. Everyone wants Montana to be not a state, but a state of mind.
One obituary that I read is that while she was driving back to California from Montana, where, by the way, she met her husband in Montana, Mark. He was a river ranger up there. But it was on the way back to California that she discovered the Southwest. And she talked to Dennis Lithgow of the Deseret News several years back and told him that she pulled over to the side of the road to go to the ladies' room when she was in the Southwest. And she said then decided to stay there for a month. Says she couldn't believe what she was seeing. Don, you first. What drew her to the desert? Because once she saw it, it seems she wanted to stay.
That's I think, something of an enigma that draws anyone to the desert who wasn't native to the desert. And it's part of the apparatus, you might say, of desert literature and desert writing. Many desert writers, living writers today, writers of the past, did not grow up in desert environments. They came to them at some point in their life, early life, midlife, or whatever. D.H. Lawrence, Edward Abbey, famously from western Pennsylvania, deciduous forests of the northern reaches of the Appalachian mountain range. Ellen had that kind of similar epiphany that many people have that's, I think, really kind of hard to pin down, hard to explain, but the identifying, the field marks of it are pretty clear. There's an arresting quality to those landscapes, the clarity of the air, the feeling of aridity, that much dryness when you're really not used to it, the length of the vistas, all that red rock, all that sparse vegetation. Some combination of those ingredients called to her, and then to top it all off, largely because of Mark Molloy's work with BLM on rivers, she had desert rivers at her fingertips and the tips of her toes. So she had the opportunity to be in desert canyons pretty much around the year, certainly during the warm months. And I think that set of ingredients was really what grabbed her and held her. I'd actually never heard that story about her driving to California and stopping at the ladies' room. But nothing in that surprises me.
Yeah. And I guess when you saw her interact with that place, because place is important, and we'll get to that here in a moment, but she must have seemed completely just at home, really part of that place in some ways.
Oh, absolutely. There was no question about that. I met her when she came to build a house in Bluff about the same time that my family and I built one. And I would have guessed she had always lived in the desert. She was very tan. She loved to have her skin bared to the sun and was fascinated by every small detail, especially the quirky ones of the piece of desert ground she was building a house on. She seemed like she'd been born there.
Well, it's interesting. She said to, she did this interview with NPR's Howard Berkus, and she says sometimes she can't tell where her body ends and the desert begins.
I believe it.
Yeah. I mean, and there was this thing where she talks about, there's this piece that she, where she's writing in Anthropology of Turquoise, where she says, there's more to this bond than, as she puts it, a cosmic flakiness. And she writes about how E.O. Wilson would talk about how people, and this is, she quotes him, and this is one of the characteristics, I think, in her writing, where she would sneak in bits of science and bits of natural history, but she quotes E.O. Wilson, who said that people gravitate to environments that reward their hereditary inclinations. So I think she felt like biologically she was at home in the desert.
You know, she did come from California originally, which is a pretty dry place. if you're not on the coast. And she loved her experiences there. So I think it was quite natural for her to feel at home in the desert, really. Plus, there's something about the spaciousness of it, the scope of that country that just gives you room to be as eccentric as you want to be. Mm-hmm. And Ellen was an eccentric, and that's what we love about her. She saw the world from that point of view.
Is that why she took to Bluff? I mean, I've often heard Bluff, Utah, as on one hand being, you know, a conventional rural Utah place, but also being pretty eccentric. And
it
there
is.
Must be, yeah?
Especially maybe back then, you know. But, well, it's out there for one thing.
You
didn't get electricity till 58, which seems a long time ago now, but isn't that long ago. And it's always kind of been an outpost for people, I think. And it's a border town. You know, it's right on the border of the Navajo Reservation.
Yeah.
And it has its long Mormon tradition. So it's a kind of multicultural place. But the multiculture also includes uranium miners. There were, when Ellen and I came there, there were lots of old guys who'd been uranium miners or truck drivers, just people hiding out. So it's just a place, I think, that collected people that are not in the usual rural community.
It's interesting. The essays that she wrote for us, she didn't really say that much directly about Mormon culture, that I recall anyway. How did she negotiate that culture? I mean, there were a lot of cultures going on. Obviously, she wrote about Navajo people, and she wrote about uranium miners, as you mentioned. She wrote about others. But how did she negotiate her place in that kind of conventional part of Bluff, Utah's culture?
One of Ellen's other contradictions for me, I think she was really rather shy and really a little awkward in company, but she was just one of the most gracious people I have known. She was interested in everybody. She liked to go to the post office, you know, make observations, and I'm sure that included her Mormon neighbors.
In 1997, Ellen wrote a piece for us about her favorite day at the post office, when many of the rural Navajos come to pick up their Social Security checks. She writes, "If the retirement check comes in and if the family is fed, then the only other wealth you need is the lost beauty of Indian country around you." Here's an essay called Rural Realities.
On Tuesdays, a county services van collects elderly Navajos from remote parts of the reservation and brings them to town for the day. The van, filled with aged men and women, stops at the post office. When the young driver opens the door, out billows a crashing boom of radio set at top volume for poorly functioning hearing aids. Usually it's chants on the tape deck, or rapid-fire Navajo on KTNN from Chinle, Arizona, heavy on the bass. On a town day, the seniors always dress up. The men wear faded snap shirts, black Stetsons, and belts ablaze with silver and turquoise. The women's style embodies their tribe's legendary ability to adopt ideas from other cultures, then ground them as essential Navajo traits. Their long fluted cotton skirts and velveteen blouses date back to Pueblo and ultimately Spanish influence. Their headscarves are pure 1950s. They wear hot pink or lime green canvas keds with orange crew socks. They are loaded down with the family wealth of turquoise and silver jewelry. There are no pastels here. Every color draws from the desert around us, crimson and vermilion from sandstone cliffs lit by the sun, deep indigo from the shadows, purple and emerald from the far mesas. For a Navajo, color is not just a color, but a universe, a reflection of a profound bond between land and human.
Ellen Molloy, she died in November of 2004. We're partnering with Torrey House Press to publish a collection of the radio essays Ellen wrote for KUER in the 1990s. The book is called Seasons, Desert Sketches by Ellen Molloy. We're joined today by Ann Weiler-Walka, a poet and naturalist focused on the Colorado Plateau, and Donald Snow, who's chair of the Environmental Humanities at Whitman College in Walla Walla, Washington. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Hi, I'm Elaine Clark, one of the producers for Radio West. So a couple of years ago, Doug remembered a story he had produced back in the 90s, which sort of sent me on an adventure to go find it. Now, I'm the archive nerd on our team, and I ended up digitizing nearly 1,500 KUER stories that aired from 1991 to 1998. Among those were essays by Utah writer Ellen Molloy, and when we heard them again, we realized that her voice is as relevant today as it was 20 years ago. So we've partnered with Torrey House Press to publish these 26 essays as a book. It's coming out next April, but KUER listeners can get an advanced copy for a pledge of $120 or an ongoing gift of $10 a month. Go online to KUER.org to get a copy of the book. It's called Seasons, Desert Sketches by Ellen Molloy. Your donation directly supports Radio West. So thank you.
This is Radio Westenberg Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're remembering the writer Ellen Molloy. Ellen died in 2004, and not so long ago, we found some of the essays she had written for us here at KUER. So we've partnered with Torrey House Press to publish the essays in a book called Seasons, Desert Sketches by Ellen Molloy, which is giving us a chance to today talk about Ellen, her life, and her work with Ann Weiler-Walka, a poet and naturalist, also a friend of Ellen's, and Donald Snow, the chair of environmental humanities at Whitman College in Walla Walla, Washington, also a friend. They both serve on the board of the Ellen Molloy Fund for Desert Writers. Donald Snow, you say a familiar theme in her work is place. I wanted you to talk a bit about that. Why did she believe having a kind of awareness, a deep awareness of where you are and where you settle is so important, do you think?
At the more superficial level, it's part of a tradition in the nature writing tradition itself, both British tradition, American tradition, really all over the world. One of the key layers or vectors of nature writing is attention paid to place, to the point where today it's become a kind of a cliché. A man named Henry Thoreau goes out to a pond, builds a cabin, and spends 2 years, and then writes about the place, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
At a deeper level, Ellen spoke of something that she called a deep map of place, by which she didn't necessarily mean drawing representations of places spatially on paper, although she did some of that. It more meant mapping the place in terms of a kind of a terrain, a ceaseless terrain of consciousness. And that individual consciousness was all the time relating to the place. It was like a co-emanation, and they somehow meet on the page in her work. The desert place becomes a very, very valuable surrounding for her, and it's not just bluff, and it's not just the San Juan River, and it's not just Desolation Canyon on the Green, the places that she wrote about specifically. It's this whole emanation of a dry region, a dry part of a large continent, and her keen eye for the people of that place, the people who had been there for millennia, in the case of Native American people, the newcomers who had adopted it and tried to make it their home through some very different attitudes about those places and proper economics and the like there, Mormon culture, for example, in southern Utah. I think all of that was very exciting to Ellen in a quiet, kind of a quiet excitement. So she was concerned about place as well. It all sounds so pretty when I put it the way I'm putting it here, but these places are often imperiled. They're fraught. They're a problem. Anywhere human beings live, there are problems, of course. Mm. Ellen was also concerned about the way people were affecting those places, particularly in environmental and ecological terms. So when you get to the first book, Raven's Exile, there's this really deep concern that runs all the way through the book. It's a beautiful book. It's a very funny book. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, back to what Ann said about Ellen's seriousness, there is a deep and serious concern for the health of that river, the Green River, and then, of course, the Colorado that the Green is a major tributary of. That shows up, again, over and over in Ellen's work. And it's not that she's writing environmental diatribes. It's nothing like that. But there is that concern and I think her belief that places need to be cared for. They certainly care for us we need to emanate that care back toward those places.
Did she think of herself, even in her writing, as a kind of activist for the environment? Did she think in those terms?
That's a complex question. I can tell you that the short answer is yes. There definitely was a kind of an activist motif. And that's when I first met Ellen in graduate school in the University of Montana. We met in a graduate program at the University of Montana, the Environmental Studies program, that has never made a deep secret about the fact that it exists pretty much to train environmental activists or advocates at the graduate level. And Ellen was attracted to that program when the program was very new. I came in the class right after her. She started in 77 and I started in 78. Ellen had some true interests in activism per se. And in fact, after grad school, I hired Ellen at an activist organization in Helena, Montana called the Montana Environmental Information Center. Ellen was our communications director, but actually became a legislative lobbyist at the Montana State Legislature. Not surprisingly, the issue that she chose to work on most was water and the condition of Montana's rivers. So there was a strong kind of undertow in her later stages of her academic career in what was happening out in the world in environmental politics. And she took part in that to a certain degree. I never saw when she began entering into a new career as a writer and illustrator, I never saw that as Ellen backing away from activism or advocacy. I saw that activism and advocacy taking a different form in her work. Hmm. I think she thought that it might be more persuasive to do it the way she chose to do it, and she certainly did it well.
Yeah. Anne, your sense of Ellen in Bluff as an environmentalist, did she, you know, talk in that way to the neighbors? Did she come across that way as having a kind of deep environmental sensibility?
Oh, I think so. I think she would avoid being too confrontational about it with the neighbors, but she was always very clear about how much she cared. And I don't think she could help talking about it.
Yeah.
And she did some great things in Bluff. You know, she worked very hard to get a conservation easement for a big farm that is adjacent to the town to keep it from being developed. And she wrote a wonderful little brochure about Bluff to really inform people about the place. And I think, you know, make them, as they pass through, respect it and find it as charming as she did. And take care of it. So I think she was, in many ways, a very active environmentalist. But I agree with Don, though, that in her writing, well, sometimes it's there, but never in a preachy way. More just, wow, look at this. Look what's happened here, kind of a way. And she certainly didn't hammer away at it in her writing as some environmental writers do.
Don, to that point, you say Ellen was a committed environmentalist, but that she didn't use the rhetoric of an environmentalist.
No.
One of the things I remember, a quote from her was that she saw a great deal of nature writing sounds like a cross between chloroform stupor and a high mass. Don, you've talked about the fact that she even found Leopold. Aldo Leopold is a bit, I think, dreary is how you put it.
Yeah, there was that, and I think there was sincerity in that quip, as Anne again said earlier. The flip side of Ellen's funniness was Ellen's seriousness, and that's not unique to Ellen. Often humor is exactly that. It sort of smiles about something that maybe we really ought not be smiling about. And one of those things was, she observed as an activist. I saw her working literally as an activist in the state of Montana, I mean, within the halls of the legislature. And there's something about that that's a little bit heavy, a little bit priggish. It often becomes kind of self-righteous, frankly. It's not what people intend. That's not what they're trying to do. But there's part of that earnestness that tends to overreach and go overboard. And when that begins to happen in language, Ellen sort of recoiled from that. And then in her good-natured and hilarious way, she had a tendency to make fun of that and to make light of that. One of the greatest ongoing jokes in her work is the joke that's always on Ellen herself. Ellen noticed those tendencies in herself, and she laughed about those. She wrote about those and reflected those ironically in her work. What she didn't do was enter into what you might call the world of polemical writing. There's never a harangue in her work. You're never being told how to vote, what to think, how you ought to think. Instead, you're being introduced to situations about which thoughtfulness might make a difference. For example, the condition of several not very well-known and not very well-loved species of desert fish that are endemic to those murky rivers down in the Southwest. Ellen loved those fish and understood that they were imperiled, that they didn't really have a constituency. So her approach to, if you will, the politics of ichthyology, the politics of fish, was to introduce you to the fish themselves. They become not cutesy cartoon characters, but in a meaningful sense, figures in her stories. Her aim was to get the reader to kind of like those fish, fish that the reader had probably never heard of.
There's also a piece that we broadcast where Ellen was dealing with the controversy of reintroducing wolves into Yellowstone, and her take was, well, as you'll hear, unique and pretty funny.
Tonight, a man spoke against reintroducing wolves in the West. The wolf kills for a living, he said. I wonder if people who want wolves back would be so enthusiastic if they actually saw a wolf pack jump on some deer and eat that animal alive. He's right, I thought, pushing my plate aside. Nature is rude and wolves should change their ways. First, they should dump that disgusting pack technique and hire someone to procure their food. Next, they should sit up and use forks like the rest of us. Consign a few picnic tables to wolf packs, hand out bibs and moose liver, no longer pulsating, of course, and while we're at it, make them wear pants, so no family from Iowa has to suffer the sight of a rangy pack of buck-naked canids gnawing elk legs 20 yards from a souvenir shop.
Later in the piece, Ellen writes that in our confusion about nature's ways, we end up taking it out on the creatures themselves.
Westerners live closer to wildlife than most people. When we see an elk, we know if it is right side up. We know the difference between a coyote and a poodle. So why suffer these outbreaks of animal anxiety? Perhaps the sight of natural predation, wolves bringing down an elk and eating it with the teeth they were born with, triggers the uneasy revelation that humans are animals. Perhaps we pick on other creatures because we know we can be quite beastly ourselves. The ways of wild food are so remote from our minds, we forget that we, too, are part of the feast. We're the executioner. Sometimes we're the entree. Just ask a grizzly bear or a shark. Less and less we are the witness. So estranged are we from wild animals on their own terms, we insist they live on ours, or be gone.
Donald Snow, she loved animals. I think you mentioned to us that when she lost one of her pet dogs, she was utterly devastated.
That's true. I think I said at the time then, I'd never seen anybody quite so deeply affected by the loss of a pet. The dog's name was actually Coeur d'Alene, Heart of Ellen. It was this beautiful golden retriever, female. It got hit and killed, I think, on U.S. Highway 93 right outside of her home in the Bitterroot Valley. This was back when she and I were both in graduate school. She did love animals at large and had a particular love for canines of all kinds. A little known fact about Ellen, even to her readership, is that her master's thesis at the University of Montana was titled Song Dog, as in the dog which sings, and it was an extended essay on coyotes. It was Ellen's kind of first attempts at the kind of writing that she later went on to perfect. She was very interested in coyotes. She was very interested in wolves. She was interested in the issue of wolf reintroduction, which is partly why she wrote the essay we just heard from. But she also saw this kind of great spirit in domestic dogs, treated her dogs very well. And then had this one terribly unfortunate incident with the death of a dog. I think a little bit later in life, she kind of got away from keeping pets. The last couple of times I visited Ellen and Mark, I don't recall that they had a dog. Certainly wasn't as prominent as it was when she was younger. But it was, I think, that canine love emanated outwards into the love of many other animals, species other than human beings. So again, she follows some of the familiar patterns of earlier nature literature in thinking about those other species in meaningful ways, taking animals seriously, thinking of them as considerable feeling creatures instead of mute brute beasts.
When I knew her in Bluff, she never had a dog. I don't know if she ever did after that one was killed. I remember Mark talking about that. But she really did have great affection for the animals that lived outside her house. And she didn't try to tame them. She just was a wonderful observer of them, the lizards and the sais phoebes that nested in the eaves and the snakes that came looking for the phoebe chicks. She and Mark both. He had a close relationship, I think, with those animals.
It was those animals around her that she talks about in this essay from the year 2000. This one is called Guests.
My house is surrounded by a menagerie of wildlife. They think of us as their pets, or, at best, as interesting as fence posts. They believe we built the house for them, creating shelters, stones to bask on, insects to eat, flowers to sip. All of us, the wildlife and we fence posts, live in a peaceful state of anarchy. Hummingbirds the size of a heartbeat collide full speed into the window screens. With beaks stuck in the small squares, they madly vibrate their wings in reverse and go nowhere. I punch them out of the vise with the flat of my hand, trying not to snap off their beaks. Pheasants squawk, ravens quark, geese honk, the coyotes yip and yowl all night. By day, it rains lizards. Two spiny lizards chase and wrestle one another, scramble up a cottonwood, then drop at my feet when I pass. The lizards are so inflated with reptilian machismo, you could strap one to each foot and skate off. Someone leaves a door open, and a side-blotched lizard, Uta stensburiana, tiptoes inside to explore the fence post's inner sanctum. When it sees me, it tries to race across the smooth clay tiles, its little lizard feet scrabbling madly in place. A cricket takes up residence in my husband's closet. At night, it sings love songs to his hiking boots. The toad that lives under the mint bushes plops around the breezeway, then flings itself against a window. I think it's headed for the bathtub. These creatures allow us to reside alongside them, to witness their lives. I know this for certain when a bull snake shows up. Bull snakes are harmless, cream-colored reptiles with brown markings. Behind each eye is a stroke of black, like the Kohl eye makeup of an Egyptian queen. This bull snake starts at the top of the breezeway stairs, next to the bleached white hip bone of a cow. She slips down from the bone, her long, supple body perfectly stair-stepped along the contours of the descent. She drops her scarlet tongue into a pool of water left from a hose, and she drinks. I see her cheeks inflate with each sip. I go about my business, thinking about a snake that laps up water like a thirsty dog. When I return, she has assumed siesta position in a lawn chair, her tail draped over the seat, like a casual whip. This snake has an aura of mischief about her, not slow and sinister, but curious, oblivious to us, but not to our possibilities. The snake keeps down the mice and chases off rattlesnakes. The bug-eating birds and lizards are cheaper, safer, and more fun than insecticides. Hummingbirds invite me to fill our lives with flowers. Toads reassure us that there is a lot of sex going on. We think of our domestic wildlife as useful. I don't know what they think of us, but I know that they, not we, are the hosts on this shaggy piece of desert. One day I chased two Utas out of my living room. It isn't easy herding lizards. One night, outside, a tiny bat hooks itself high in the stucco wall to rest. I stand on my head to better observe this upside-down winged mouse. When you're a guest, you adjust.
Donald Snow, you've talked about how Ellen could be disheveled, kind of out in nature, you know, when she was on a river trip. But that wasn't how she worked as a writer, that she was very careful, that she was kind of a perfectionist, a perfectionist in her craft. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, certainly. So the context of that was another way in which I knew Ellen was as one of her editors when she first started writing and publishing her work. At that time, I had left Helena and come back over to Missoula and had become the director of an organization called the Northern Lights Institute. In 1985, we launched a journal called Northern Lights Magazine. And the journal went on for many years, almost 20 years, kind of to our astonishment. Ellen was one of the first writers we began publishing in Northern Lights. She was also an illustrator, so we ran a whole lot of her illustrations and cartoons. She did a lot of cartooning, wonderful cartoons. Hmm. And I remember we were getting manuscripts from all kinds of people. We'd sometimes get hundreds of manuscripts a year, some solicited, some unsolicited. Those that we would choose for publication would be in various degrees of good or bad shape, put it that way.
Yeah.
Some writers are disheveled writers. Their manuscripts are hard to work through. You have to spend a lot of time on them. You have a lot of correction to do. Ellen's were just the opposite. With an Ellen Ditzler at first, an Ellen Molloy manuscript, essentially would get the manuscript, take it out of the envelope, and send it to the typesetter. I mean, of course, we'd read it, but we hardly ever had to touch a thing in it. She was, I thought, as her editor, one of her editors, a supreme perfectionist on the page. That's not just perfectionism. That's an indication in my mind of craft and a really keen eye and keen vision about exactly what she wanted to say, sentence by sentence, word by word, punctuation mark by punctuation mark. These were thoughtful pieces, and it showed up just in the way they appeared with little black marks on white backgrounds.
Mm. So I want to get a sense from you both. And Donald Snow, I wanted to start with you. She had written, of course, The Anthropology of Turquoise, nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. And it seemed like she was on her way. That she was being I think she had been discovered, but she was getting more attention as a writer. And then, of course, she tragically dies in November of 2004. And this was 3 months after she had finished the next book, Eating Stone, Imagination and the Loss of the Wild. Give us a sense of where you think she was headed before she died.
I remember Ellen at one point telling me that she wasn't sure she wanted to continue writing books. Eating Stone was it's the fourth and final book, final because of her death, but it also may have been final in the sense that she seemed to be moving in a different direction. Writing is a very taxing occupation. People who don't write, especially write for a living, have no idea just how hard it is, how time-consuming it is, how emotionally draining it can be. Ellen and Mark at one point had started to travel down to Baja and were hanging out on the Sea of Cortez and catching fish out of the ocean and living a kind of a glorious beach life. And there was a part of Ellen, I think, in what turned out to be late in her life, none of us knew it was late in her life, I think that kind of wanted to do a lot more of that, to move to a place where she wasn't surrounded by all of the haunting visions of loss. One of the other great vectors of nature writing is that it is frequently a literature of loss. It has been said of the nature writers that they largely write elegies, which of course are poems to the dead or dying. And the natural world is not in good shape, and Ellen knew that. I think there was something about that lovely life on the beach down south, away even from the United States, that beckoned to her. So I don't know where she might have gone next as a writer, but it wouldn't have surprised me had she lived that she might have just kind of closed up shop as a writer. Sometimes writers do that.
Anne, what do you think?
Well, I definitely remember her saying that too when she was working on Eating Stone, that she wasn't going to do this anymore. And, you know, especially with Ellen's commitment to her work and to crafting her work. It's a kind of a lonely thing being a writer. And I agree with Don that she was confronted with much loss. And if she had lived longer and continued to write, it would have been even more the case. So it's interesting to think about Ellen not writing, on the other hand, because she did it. She did it. Within how many years she wrote her four books, but it wasn't much more than 10, I don't think. Mm. 10 is how long I knew her. And she was so good at it. So I don't, sometimes when you're a writer, that's where how you think is when you're writing, and she might have missed that. But on the other hand, I can certainly see her, and if you read this little essay, season wrap-up, how much she just loved being there and not worrying about the losses. So maybe that she would have done that. I like thinking about that, Don.
If I could just add to what Ann just said so beautifully, I watched Ellen go into a kind of a cocoon as a graduate student and emerge with these gorgeous wings. And I sometimes tell students that at Whitman College, that this was one opportunity I had to watch the genesis and development of an artist in the making. When you read books that are published and beautifully produced the way her books are, there's a tendency to kind of take them for granted, like there's an inevitability to the book and to the person who wrote it and their task. Mm-hmm. Well, that's almost never the case. In Ellen's case, she had these dreams that she didn't share with many people. Not very many people knew that Ellen had aspirations to become the writer she became. I only knew it because Ellen and I had a lot of conversations about writing, and we were both writing and wanting to publish work and the like. What I watched her do was enter into this, from her master's thesis, as I mentioned earlier, on The Coyote. She was not proud of that work. I watched her go through this series of transformational steps, which absolutely astounded me. A person I knew emerged, it seemed to me, rather quickly as a great literary artist. There's an alchemical thing to that. How does that happen? Part of it is just passion and the depth of care that woman carried into all of her work. I think Ellen had her heart broken repeatedly by her love of the desert rivers and desert communities, and I think that finally became, I wouldn't say it was sour to her, but it was something that caused her to turn, I think, away. It wasn't in spite of the passion. It was because of the passion.
When Ellen died in November of 2004, I went on the air and mentioned how there was a kind of symmetry in her death coming at the end of a season on the river. In Raven's Exile, she says that she would always linger before leaving the Green River, but then she would, as she put it, nose the truck south and head for home, where she could wander the banks of the San Juan River and the canyons that she described as aflame with yellow cottonwoods in the peak of fall color, October light purified. In October of 1995, Ellen wrote a piece that Anne referred to called Season Wrap-Up.
For thousands of days, my life has been ruled by the Green River, by its flow and the distance it takes me each day, by its speed and volume, its ever-changing light. This morning, the river is noisy with the rapid near camp. It is red, not from sediment, but from the reflection of salmon-red canyon walls on the water. Raft loaded, we shove off the gravel bar and pinball across the rocky shallows into the current. Low water requires work. The raft floor barely skims over shallow bars, like the one called Deviated Septum Riffle. I named it when an oar blade struck bottom and propelled the shaft like a spear into my nose. It was a painful lesson about rowing too deeply. Above rapids, I cannot see the runs through the dazzling glare of low-slung sun that splinters the river's surface into blinding fragments. At this low volume, the rocks are meaner. Some runs require threading the needle maneuvers and a folding in of oars to avoid smashing them into a maze of exposed boulders. After living in Desolation Canyon for 6 months, 20 days a month, with oars in my fists, The river's muscle shows itself in my arms and back, and in calluses so thick, winter's respite won't be long enough to soften them. My hands will be ready to take the oars next spring without blistering. Sun and papery dry air have mapped themselves on our hides. Tenderness lives in the lines at the corners of my husband's eyes. When I stand against the sandstone, he says, there is no difference between me and the Red Gold Canyon. I have turned the color of desolation.
Ellen Molloy, who died in November of 2004. We're partnering with Torrey House Press to publish the collection of radio essays that Ellen wrote for KUER in the 1990s. The book is called Seasons, Desert Sketches by Ellen Molloy. Ann Weiler-Walka is a poet and naturalist focused on the Colorado Plateau. She joined us from the radio station KNAU in Flagstaff. Ann, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed very much thinking about Ellen.
And Donald Snow, chair of environmental humanities at Whitman College in Walla Walla, Washington, joined us from a studio there in Walla Walla. Professor Snow, thanks to you.
Oh, thank you. Great pleasure.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Annie Lane Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.